So there's a serious proposal on the table this hour. Should we genetically engineer the extinction of disease-carrying species of mosquitoes? The technology seems to exist, and some pretty prominent scientists think that we should. Well, let's check in with Sonia Shah. She's a science journalist who writes about pandemics and pathogens and the social history of disease. She wrote one of the best histories of malaria. It's a book called The Fever, and she has a pretty different perspective on the whole kill or be killed debate. One of the reasons that we haven't gotten rid of malaria or of the mosquitoes that cause it has to do not just with science, but with politics and economics. Can you sort of explain a bit more?
So people who are poor are more likely to get malaria, and that's because they live in ways that exposes them to mosquitoes. They live in rudimentary housing without screens on their windows or without screens on their doors. This allows mosquitoes to come in. They're less likely to have electricity, which means they are outdoors more and they're not indoors at night, potentially being exposed to mosquitoes. And then they live on, you know, kind of marginal lands with poorly drained roads around them, and these capture standing water where mosquitoes can breed. So just by virtue of, you know, living in poverty, you're much more likely to get bitten by mosquitoes.
Mm. And then there's a culture as well, right? I mean, for instance, your family is from India and you grew up spending summers there. But I've heard you say that when you told them that you were going to be writing a book about malaria, they all thought you were crazy.
Yeah, they thought I must have been desperate for book ideas or something, because to them, writing a book about malaria is like writing a book about warts or like the common cold, or, you know, just something so ordinary that why would it be interesting? Why would you ever write about that? That gets to the heart of sort of the cultural problem of mosquito-borne diseases like malaria, which is that the people who have the most malaria tend to kind of care about it the least. It becomes kind of a normal problem of life. And this is something medical anthropologists have found again and again. Like, you and I might think of malaria as a killer disease that you would do anything to avoid. But people who live with a lot of malaria, they don't think of it that way.
Hmm. And that makes it harder to fight. Why? Because people are less likely to, I don't know, sleep under their bed nets or get to the doctor the first time they have an infection?
Yeah, all of those things. You know, I mean, most of these interventions that we've come up with for controlling malaria rely upon people at risk of malaria taking actions. You know, they either have to go to the doctor as soon as they get sick to get diagnosed and to get their prescriptions, and then they have to fill the prescriptions and they have to keep taking the drugs. They have to sleep under the net every night. They have to put on the repellents. These are all things that require them to feel like this is important and this is worth doing. But, you know, think about what you or I, or those of us who live in temperate parts of the world, think about the precautions we take to protect ourselves, say, against flu or colds. I mean, we barely wash our hands enough, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, say you had like a bunch of experts from Africa come over to the United States and say, you know, you people are losing $40 billion a year on cold and flu, and all these people are dying every year. You know, all you have to do is wear a mask over your face for, you know, 6 weeks of flu season when you go to school or work.
And it would be easy for you to say.
Well, exactly. We would say, why bother? We'll just get a cold.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of our war on mosquitoes. And even just as I say that, I'm thinking how interesting it is that we use the language and the logic of conquest to talk about dealing with mosquitoes. You know, it's always a war. We're always trying to come up with the next weapon to use against them. Maybe that's just inevitable, or is there actually a problem embedded in that?
If you look in the long view, we've spent a lot of time and money trying to control mosquitoes, but we've also let a lot of things slide. I mean, ever since we've come up with powerful insecticides, you know, probably since the 1940s with the development of DDT, we've done a lot less with sort of managing the environment or looking really deeply into mosquito biology and mosquito ecology to see how we could tinker with it so that we could actually live with mosquitoes and without the diseases they carry. You know, we've kind of taken this all-out slaughter approach because we've developed enough powerful insecticides that can do that. So we're not really doing enough in terms of kind of a specialized attack on the exact kind of mosquitoes and the exact kind of mosquito bait behaviors that we're trying to control.
But I really like your point that that in some ways what we're doing is trying to just wipe out, you know, an entire population. And that's one model, but that a different model, which suggested, well, let's see how we can live with these things, you know, or maybe only kill a few of them, that might actually open up the door to different paradigms for thinking about how to get rid of them.
I mean, in the end, what we have to rupture and reduce is mosquito biting of people. You know, and we've seen in other parts of the world that sometimes, and this is not all species of mosquitoes, some are very, very focused on biting humans and only humans. But there's other species of mosquitoes that are more flexible. In England, in southern England, they used to have a lot of malaria there. And this was back when they didn't have a big livestock herds because they didn't have, you know, good enough agriculture to keep their livestock herds alive during the winter and things like that. So when they introduced four-crop rotation into England, this allowed for larger harvests and more fodder crops, and they could keep their livestock alive for longer. So they had bigger and bigger herds of cow and sheep. And this ended up reducing malaria to such an extent that it eventually vanished because the malaria mosquitoes, it turns out, they didn't have any choice before that. But once there was all these sheep and cow and pig around, they preferred to bite them.
So we just offer them an alternative prey.
Yeah, I mean, there was actually Rockefeller Foundation scientists who said at the time the cure for malaria might be just a pig under every bed.
That might be a lot cheaper than what we're doing now.
Yeah, a little messy, but yeah, cheaper.
Well, that makes me think, you know, malaria used to be a big problem in the United States. I mean, you're living in near Baltimore in a place that was formerly ravaged by yellow fever and malaria. But we don't have much malaria in the U.S. today. So how did we stop it?
Well, there's a number of things we did, and we did most of them without thinking about malaria. We just did them for other reasons. We got rid of about half of our wetlands. You know, and that was the urban expansion and the expansion of our farms and things. So that destroyed a lot of mosquito habitat. And then we had malaria kind of hanging on, particularly in the South, particularly among sharecroppers. Because these were people who were, you know, living on marginal lands. They were living in shacks. They didn't have electricity. So in all these ways, they had what I would call a malarious way of life. And we kind of ended that by social policy. We started the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which mechanized farms, Tennessee Valley Authority, which brought electricity to rural areas. And all of that really ended that malarious way of life. And as we ended that malarious way of life, malaria vanished too.
Are you suggesting that instead of focusing so much on combating malaria in other parts of the world, it might be better to focus on combating poverty?
I think so, and I think there's another reason why that would make more sense, which is that people actually want help with that. You know, people in malarious countries and malarious societies don't necessarily feel that malaria is their top problem in life. They feel like their top problem in life is better job, better harvests, more financial security, a future for their children, education, things like that. So really, we're talking about just basic development, basic economic prosperity. And there are malaria scientists who say that what we need to do to end malaria is basically have, you know, centers of economic development where people can become a little bit more prosperous. And if they become a little bit more prosperous, they'll get more electricity and they'll have better homes and they'll start grading the streets so there's not as much standing water. And you kind of build that out in sort of concentric circles until you have a cycle of more wealth, more health, more wealth, more health.
Do you think there's something patronizing about our current efforts to combat malaria? Because most are led by Western scientists or Western philanthropists like Bill and Melinda Gates, for instance. And it sounds like you're suggesting, well, we're combating what we think is a problem, but it may not be the same problem that people in the countries with malaria think they have.
Yeah, I think there is a definite sort of cultural collision, some cognitive dissonance in the way people who have malaria experience the disease and the way the people who have the wherewithal to fight malaria experience the disease. And that has led to, you know, certain problems where we decided here in the West, Western scientists decided that, well, why don't we treat all these bed nets with insecticide, and that'll last for 5 to 7 years. It's really cheap, it's really easy, and we can distribute this by the hundreds of millions across malarious Africa. But in fact, what was happening is they were distributing the nets, but people weren't actually using them.
Why not?
Well, there's a number of problems. Well, you know, sometimes it was a square net and they live in a round hut, or this net was the nicest thing that they had. You know, these are really poor people living in remote areas. And this was the nicest thing that they had, this, like, you know, very well-made synthetic material with a fine mesh. So they used it for other things that they valued more, like fishing nets or curtains or even wedding veils. Some people would just store them and only bring them out when, you know, honored guests came to kind of show, you know, show them that they had this thing. So it just didn't fit into people's lives the way that we might have imagined it did.
So what should we be doing? I mean, if you could be, I don't know, world mosquito czar, what would you do?
I don't think I want that job. I think malaria really is 1,000 different diseases. It's different everywhere it occurs. So it's almost like a local issue, you know, and we can empower local communities to come up with local solutions. And sometimes those actually can be fairly simple. And there's some really great examples of that. And for example, in Dar es Salaam, where, you know, local research revealed that the malaria mosquitoes were breeding in the drainage ditches that were blocked by garbage. And so the malaria intervention became, let's hire some kids to clear this garbage out, you know, and this allowed the water to run through. And that actually worked to bring malaria down, too. Yeah. That's not going to work everywhere. You know, that'll work in that one place. In parts of China, they found that malaria mosquitoes were breeding in the irrigation canals in rice farms. And so the malaria intervention became, well, let's raise the level of the water in these irrigation canals, and that washed the mosquito eggs away. Or they would lower it, and that would leave the mosquito eggs kind of high and dry, and they would desiccate. And that worked to bring malaria down. But it's not going to work everywhere.
Sonia Shah is a science writer and author of The Fever, How Malaria Has Ruled Humankind for 500,000 Years. She's also just come out with a new book called The Pandemic.